Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. For the first time since the Omicron-fueled fourth COVID wave began, Africa has seen a significant drop in new cases and a promising dip in reported deaths. That's the message on Thursday from the UN Health Agency, which said that cases fell by 20% in the week to the 16th of January, while deaths dropped by 8%. World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa, Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, said that there have now been more than 10.4 million cases of COVID-19 on the African continent and over 234,000 lives lost as a result of the pandemic.
I take this opportunity to stress that while the impact of this latest peak has been moderate, the continent has yet to turn the tide on this pandemic, so there is no room for complacency. So long as the virus continues to circulate, further pandemic waves are inevitable. Africa must not only broaden vaccinations, but also gain increased and equitable access to critical COVID-19 therapeutics to save lives and effectively combat this pandemic.
Dr. Moeti said that while four African subregions reported a fall in new infections, cases have spiked in North Africa by 55%. In particular, Tunisia and Morocco have seen an exponential increase, overtaking South Africa as the countries with the most cases on the continent. One of the largest coral reefs in the world has been discovered by a UN-supported scientific mission off the coast of Tahiti. Announcing the stunning find on Thursday, UNESCO said that divers had explored large rose-shaped corals spanning some 3 kilometres at depths of between 30 and 65 metres. Early indications suggest that its depth has protected the reef from bleaching caused by global warming. French lead diver Alexei Rosenfeld and founder of the One Ocean campaign described seeing the rose corals stretch as far as the eye could see. It was like a work of art, he said. The reef find is highly unusual because of its deep location, as the vast majority of the world's known coral reefs only descend to around 25 meters. It suggests that there are many more large reefs to be found, as only 20% of the entire seabed has been mapped at depths of more than 30 meters, said UNESCO Director General Audrey Azoulay. Desertification in Africa is a major headache for farmers, but a state-of-the-art digger could change all that, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization FAO said on Thursday. To help counter poor soils, erratic rainfall and drought, the FAO is restoring degraded land with the help of the Delfino plough machine in Burkina Faso, Niger, Nigeria and Senegal. It works by creating large half-moon planting areas, boosting rainwater conservation tenfold. This makes the soil softer and easier to farm than the traditional and back-breaking method of digging by hand. FAO explained that the mechanical plough is also hugely efficient, covering up to 20 hectares a day, a task which would take 100 farmers more than 2 weeks. The agency hopes that by bringing degraded agricultural land back to life, farmers will not have to clear forest to turn into cropland for Africa's rising population and growing food demands. Today, the continent loses 4 million hectares of forest every year as farmers go in search of land to cultivate. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak to Jeffrey Robinson, the creator of the new film, Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America.
The dynamite film is going to be broadcast all over the country. Go see it. This could be a game changer.
We'll also be discussing the escalating crisis in the Ukraine and how it poses imminent threat to world peace.
And we'll discuss it with Joseph Jameson of the U.S. Peace Council on the real possibility of a nuclear war.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Americans have very little understanding of their own history, and the right wants to make sure they never will. Laws are now being passed in a number of states forbidding educators from presenting an accurate portrayal of the racist past of the United States. Critical race theory, which is nothing more than a truthful accounting of U.S. history, is under attack. The documentary called Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America, has just been released in New York City and Los Angeles and will soon be available at theaters around the country. It has been featured at several film festivals and won many awards. This film is an important contribution to U.S. history. People will be enlightened about their roots. They will gain a deeper understanding of what was done to them and how they survived. Who we are arms us with knowledge, which is crucial for human progress because it informs and encourages struggle. When people understand their own history, they are empowered. That is what accounts for the tremendous popularity of Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States. Who We Are interweaves lectures, personal anecdotes, interviews, and shocking revelations. Like the Zinn book, it is also empowering. Our guest today, attorney Jeffrey Robinson, is the central figure, writer, and narrator of Who We Are. Jeffrey Robinson was a criminal defense lawyer in Seattle for decades before becoming a deputy legal director at the ACLU National Office in New York. In 2021, he left the ACLU, completed the documentary, and launched the Who We Are Project to widely disseminate the true history of African Americans and anti-black racism in the United States. As Jeffrey Robinson observed, his documentary was made with the goal, which was underscored by George Orwell as well, that those who control the present control the past. Those who control the past control the future. We talk with Jeffrey about the movie and his collaboration with directors Sarah Kunstler and Emily Kunstler. They previously made the widely acclaimed documentary about their father, the great civil rights attorney, William Kunstler. That film is called William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Jeffrey Robinson, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
When did this project begin?
There's a short part in the film that explains that I had a nephew living in New York who lost his parents, and he came to live with my wife and I in Seattle. And all of a sudden, I went from having no children to raising a young black man who was 13 years old, and I was terrified. And as I was reading in my fear, looking for things about raising children and also things about black children, I started finding things about our history that I had never heard before, despite having one of the best educations in America. And as I found one thing, it would lead me to two others, which would lead me to five others, which would lead me to six others. And I'm trained as a criminal defense lawyer. I was practicing as a criminal defense lawyer and, you know, dealing with systemic racism in the criminal legal system. But I had never seen this information before, and my training said, put it in a timeline. And when I did that, there was an unbroken connection from 1619 until today that does a lot to answer the question of why does America look like it does when it comes to gaps between the white community and the black community. And so I started putting this information into a talk, and was a three-hour presentation, and in April of 2017, Sarah Kunstler, who is a criminal defense lawyer in Manhattan, in New York, saw a presentation I did in Manhattan, and she and her sister Emily called me a couple of days after that. They are the daughters of William Kunstler, the famed civil rights lawyer, and they're filmmakers, and they said they wanted to have coffee with me, and I don't drink coffee, I drink hot chocolate. So they had coffee, I had chocolate, and they said, we want to make a film, and I didn't quite believe it at first, and I didn't think it was serious, but we've been looking at our calendars, and we met for the first time on June 20th, 2017, and on Juneteenth of 2018, we were in Town Hall Theater with seven cameras filming a version of my presentation that is the backbone of the film.
Jeff, what did you tell your nephew when he came to live with you?
Well, that's a complicated question, actually, because, you know, my nephew was living here in New York. He was being raised by his mother and his grandmother. And his mother had MS. You know, it's a horrible disease, and so we knew that the end was coming for her, and she died in April of 2011, and then his grandmother, who was the other person raising him, died in later that year, in 2011. So a lot of my conversations with my nephew were really about just trying to deal with the incredible loss in his life and the difficulties that any 13-year-old would have in that kind of a circumstance, and then moving 3,000 miles across the country to live with uncle and aunt who were now becoming, you know, substitute father and mother, and all of the stress that that brought. And I just thought, you know, with all of that piled on top of everything, he's this young black kid, and if there's a problem anywhere, people are going to be looking at him first. And so I, you know, had all kinds of conversations with him, but when it came to things like the criminal legal system, I just told him that if he was someplace and a problem broke out and the police showed up, they would be looking at him as soon as they stepped out of the car. I basically gave him the talk that most black parents give their kids about how to survive in America.
Jeffrey, what aspects of your history as a black person had you not heard about before?
There were so many. Two of the things that stood out greatly were the letters that the people who founded America wrote to each other during the Constitutional Convention. Human behavior is very, very interesting, and tracing back to cave drawings that are 15, 20,000 years old. There's an old Steely Dan song called The Caves of Altamira about these cave drawings in Altamira, France, and they were drawings thousands of years before civilization started to use the written language. So before there was writing, people were telling stories on cave walls of pictures of the animals that they hunted and their footprints and pictures of members of the tribe hunting them. Because when human beings think they're doing something important, they write stuff down. And the members of the Constitutional Convention thought they were doing something important, forming a country. So they wrote stuff down. And slavery was rampant in the colonies. The colonies were rich from slavery. And all of that money and all of that property and the institution itself was put right on the table during the Constitutional Convention. And I was amazed at the way our Constitution deliberately protected the institution of slavery. I think the other way, the other big area that was amazing to me is that I was taught, like many people, that there were all kinds of causes for the Civil War. And, you know, the war ended, and then, you know, there were some hard times, but then there was a civil rights movement, and basically since then everything's been fine. It's a level playing field. And the Civil War really wasn't all that much about slavery. That was part of it, but that wasn't all of it. Well, I went to the secession statements that every state that left the Union wrote. And you will find some of the most belligerent white supremacist thought that you have ever seen. They were blatant about it. One of my, I shouldn't say favorite, but one of the lines that really struck me is from the secession statement in Mississippi, where they just said blatantly, look, we got two choices. Either give up property worth $4 billion in money or secede. And you know what they did. They seceded. So I think hearing the words of people that are, you know, part of American history and hearing them say these things that would just be shocking, that's one of the things, or I think those are the kinds of things that really kind of slapped me in the face, and I thought, my God, why did no one ever teach me this?
We're talking to attorney Jeff Robinson, who's a criminal defense attorney, used to be. Now he's deeply involved in the Who We Are project. The movie that he made with Sarah and Emily Kunstler as directors is about to come out. It'll be shown in theaters around the country, and then it'll be streamed. And Jeff, I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the false narrative about the role of white supremacy and anti-black racism? What do you believe has led to the failure to make significant, lasting progress in this country on racial justice?
Well, I think it is the false narrative, and it to me it is, you know, I say it's simple. It's obviously complex, but think about it this way: if you're trying to solve a problem and you never consider the root cause of the problem, you'll come up with all kinds of solutions, but none of them will work because none of them are directed at the root cause of the problem. And so, if we are asking ourselves, why does America look this way? Why is there the huge gap between white and black America in virtually every area of living that you can think of? Why is that? Well, Jared Kushner, before the last administration left, said something like, well, President Trump has the solutions, and get this quote, to the problems black people are complaining about, but he can't want them to be successful more than they want to be successful. So that's a narrative that, you know, it's very blunt, but, you know, let's face it, many in America believe. Since the Civil Rights Movement, it's been pretty much a level playing field, and the disparities today between white and black America are based on merit and effort. And if that's what you believe, and you erase from history all of the facts that tell you no, something radically different is going on, then you'll actually think that you're right. And you'll come up with solutions that are geared toward making these people take more responsibility for themselves when that's not the problem at all. And by erasing our history of white supremacy and anti-black racism, we have erased the reasons that America looks the way it does today. And so this is a history that has been stolen from all of us. This isn't like black history. This is American history. And it was stolen from all of us. And I believe one of the reasons people are yelling and screaming about critical race theory is that they don't want the younger generation to hear the truth. Because if they hear it, they're going to demand that we do something about it.
Jeff, you write that knowledge can change people's views, people's opinions, people's behavior. Can you give us some examples of that?
I think there are examples of that throughout, you know, history and society, with all the problems that we're having with a vaccine right now. You know, when people were given knowledge about polio and what would stop it, people took the vaccine, and polio basically got erased. So that's a place where knowledge about something had an impact on people and an impact for good. Here, with our current vaccine situation, that knowledge about, you know, is this a good or bad thing, this vaccine, it seems like that knowledge has not gotten to some people, or that some people are resistant to it. And so I think maybe the person that expressed this best, maybe not best, but expressed it incredibly well, is the American author William Burroughs, who wrote the book Naked Lunch. And when he was asked, what does the title of that book mean? He said, a naked lunch is the moment when everyone has to look at what is really on the end of their fork. And part of the reason that people are so opposed to having this factual information be spread throughout the country is that people understand there are folks of good faith in this country, people who are liberal and conservative, and if they are given facts that demonstrate that something rotten to the core is at work in the racial injustice arena in America, they're going to want to do something about it. And so I think this is just human nature, and I think it's been demonstrated time and time again that giving people knowledge can change their behaviors. And I think maybe the best indication of that is how desperate some people are to keep this knowledge from folks. If they didn't think it would make a difference, they wouldn't be so desperate to keep it in the kind of erased category.
Attorney Jeffrey Robinson, you made the movie Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America, with two white women as directors. Did you have any hesitation about doing it with them?
I had hesitation about the movie, you know, in all aspects. I wasn't planning on making a movie. I was a criminal defense lawyer when I developed this presentation. I was giving it across the country, and then I came to the ACLU, and I was still giving it when I came to the ACLU. When Sarah Kunstler contacted me, I had all kinds of reservations. The first is that although I knew their name and I knew the history of their family and the work that their parents had done, it doesn't necessarily mean that their kids are going to follow in line with the parents. And, you know, the Kunstlers were anti-racist warriors. Their mother still is. So Sarah Kunstler is a criminal defense lawyer, and I know criminal defense lawyers in New York. So I called people, and I talked to them about her and whether her anti-racist views, as she expressed them to me, were really what she truly believed and acted on. And the word I got back was, this is a woman that you can trust. And the way that they approached me also made a huge difference, because they came to me and said, you've worked on this for years. You have developed the message that you want to deliver. This is your message. If we make this movie, you will own the movie. We are not going to own it with you. This is your movie. If we make this movie, you will have final say on all editorial control on what goes into the movie and what doesn't go into the movie. And as I talked with them and we considered the prospects and I got to know them better, I came to trust them. And it's a really important thing, because the history that we're talking about in this film and the history that the Who We Are Project is going to be disseminating, this history has been stolen from all of us. This isn't black history. This is American history. And it is on all of us to work to recover the history and to reckon with it. So, quite frankly, my partnership with two white women was quite intentional, because there is a message we're trying to send, which is, this is about all of us and about what we can do if we reckon with this history in order to truly move beyond it.
Jeffrey, were you reluctant to have your personal story told in the documentary?
I was very reluctant. And in fact, as we began filming, I was very clear, we're not using any of it. And Sarah and Emily would nod and say, okay, and every trip we took, they would continue to talk about it and continue to talk about it. And the conversation, I think the conversation that changed my mind was, I think we had just come back from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Dr. Tiffany Crutcher had been so open and warm with us, talking to us about the murder of her brother, introducing us to her mother and her father, allowing us to come into their home and to film in their home. And Sarah and Emily were making the point that we did that because their events in their lives were indicative of the kinds of issues that this history brings up, the kinds of issues that, you know, if this history is destroyed, that would be hidden. And so, you know, we're dealing with racism in America, and that involves school desegregation. And there was a story in my life that had to do with school desegregation, and so we told that story. Part of that story is housing discrimination. And there was a story in my family that dealt with housing discrimination. And so we told that story. And I think what they were saying, essentially, Sarah and Emily, was that if you can ask Tiffany Crutcher to open up and reveal some personal things in order to make this film, how can you refuse to do the same thing? That's what I ended up thinking, and I really appreciate that Sarah and Emily very respectfully just kind of nudged me the whole time, because now that the film has been made, I think the film is better with this stuff in it. I do just want to say one other thing about that. I called my parents unicorns in the movie, and they were, believe me. But please don't think that that means that they were somehow unique. There were black unicorn parents all over America at the time that I was growing up doing exactly the same thing for their kids. And I think that is one of the things that maybe you have to think about from this film. This history of racism, anti-black racism and white supremacy, is 400 years long. Yet look what we have accomplished as a community, the black community. Look what we've accomplished in spite of all of that. And think of what could happen if we removed the vestiges of that.
Jeffrey, please talk about the Who We Are project that came out of the film.
Well, until March of last year, I was a deputy legal director at the American Civil Liberties Union. I had been a criminal defense lawyer for 34 years before that, and then I was at the ACLU for 6 years. And my job was to be in charge of the ACLU's work on reforming the criminal legal system and working on racial justice. It was a fantastic job, a job that I loved. And I left it at the end of March to form the Who We Are Project, a not-for-profit organization whose goal is to educate everyone in our country about our true history of both greatness as a country and our true history of white supremacy and anti-black racism and the role that that played in the development of our country. We are going to do this education, and that is literally our focus. And let me just say, education is our focus because from all the years that I've worked in the criminal legal system, from all the years that I've worked at the ACLU, I understand that law and policy is critically important. But for us to get the right answers, for us to answer the question, how can we fix the racial injustice in America, we have got to have, as a foundational starting point, a true understanding and an accurate understanding of our history. That's the only way we'll get to the right answer. And so since this history has been hidden for so long, we are going to focus in three areas: youth, community groups, and corporate and government offices. And when I say youth, I mean kids in school, and there are states that have nothing to do with this anti-CRT nonsense, and we will work with schools in those states to develop age-appropriate curricula to help kids understand what our true history is. And kids, as you know, even in the states that have anti-CRT laws, school isn't the only place kids learn. So we are going to be on social media, on the internet, with, once again, age-appropriate materials so that kids can understand something about our history. We will do the same with community groups, everything from religious groups to secular groups to the Rotary. And then with corporate and government offices, we want to talk about how they have played a role in why our country looks like it does today, and what would happen if they decided to do something about it. That's what the Who We Are Project is going to do, and this film is simply the first thing that we have made, and we have more coming, believe me.
Every success to you, Jeffrey. Where can listeners see the movie, the name of the movie again, and how can people contact your project?
So the answer to both those questions is to go to www.thewhowearproject.org. So just one long word, thewhowearproject.org. That will give you information about what the project is doing, and there is a link where you can click to find out information on the movie, and it will take you to a map of the United States, and if you click on your state, it will show you where the film is playing and when it's playing and get you that information.
Jeffrey Robinson, you've done a terrific, just a terrific contribution here. We wish you every success, and we'll be seeing that movie again. I promise you, it is a great movie. I hope our listeners see it too. You take it easy, Jeff.
I really appreciate the time and the support. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The escalating crisis in the Ukraine and the imminent threat to world peace that it poses, than to read a portion of two short paragraphs at the beginning of that January 2nd statement on the crisis, which was issued by the U.S. Peace Council. It reads in part as follows, quote, "For weeks, the U.S. corporate media have been shrill in declaring that Russia, having positioned tens of thousands of Russian troops on the border, may be about to invade Ukraine. U.S. State Department spokesmen have been threatening Russia with punishing economic sanctions if there is an invasion," close quote. And a little bit later it goes on to say, quote, "The Cold War with Russia, festering since 2014, and the U.S.-backed coup in Ukraine, may be potentially even more menacing than the new Cold War with China. If the arms standoff between the Ukrainian military and the Russian-supported separatist forces in eastern Ukraine becomes, by miscalculation or design, a conventional war between Russia and NATO, it could escalate into nuclear war," close quote. This week, the two sides have been meeting to see if a peaceful resolution can be found. But this morning, as we're recording our show, both Russia and the U.S. announced the talks were at an impasse. What is causing this impasse? What are Russia's key demands and what are those of the United States? And what is the likelihood of war breaking out? Well, I can think of no one any better to discuss this topic with than our guest today, who is one of the authors of the U.S. Peace Council statement. He is Joseph Jameson. Mr. Jameson is a longtime peace activist and a member of the Executive Committee of the U.S. Peace Council. He is also the coordinator of the Peace Council's Move the Money to Human Needs campaign and very active in his local Move the Money campaign in New York City. Well, Joseph Jameson, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I've been listening for years, and I'm honored to be on the program.
Well, we're pleased, very pleased to have you. Joe, what role militarily and politically has the United States been playing in the Ukraine crisis in recent years, and what has been its impact on the political divisions and the military conflicts within Ukraine itself?
That's the $64,000 question. We let me just begin by pointing out we were motivated at the U.S. Peace Council to write this because we've been, over the whole month of December and even into November, we were listening to daily, almost hysterical reports about Russian troops on the border, accompanied by pictures of Vladimir Putin scowling and looking evil and looking manipulative and sinister. A whole narrative developed, and there was nobody challenging it, with a few honorable within the peace movement, when we're part of the wider U.S. peace movement, with the honorable exception of Code Pink, I would say. So we decided we better try to stir things up, and because we were alarmed. Here you have an extraordinary situation where a lot of the larger disarmament organizations, which do outstanding work on general disarmament questions, here you have the two biggest nuclear powers in the world approaching a standoff on a collision course. I mean, Russia has 6,000 nuclear weapons. The U.S. has 5,600 nuclear weapons. And they're both talking about the other side violating red lines. We decided to write something that would be provocative and explain why this crisis is escalating and why the dominant narrative about why it's escalating is absolutely not true, and talk about what we could do to begin to try to de-escalate this crisis. I just checked Google News a few minutes ago, and we've had our week of intensive diplomacy, and the two sides are now consulting with their principals to see where it goes from here. We still don't know where it goes from here, so the tensions are still exceedingly high. We still have a lot to do to begin to defuse this situation. But the U.S. role, to get to your real question, Jim, is this crisis is ultimately, although you would never know it from U.S. media, is ultimately caused by NATO and the United States encroaching for 30 years on Russian borders. If you take a look at a map, and we at our article at uspeacecouncil.org, you can see an excellent map of the addition of country after country moving with the border of NATO moving eastward, ever eastward. That puts the fear of God in the people of Russia and the government of Russia. Moreover, not only has NATO encroachment been moving toward Ukraine, the U.S. has been arming Ukraine. Within the last number of years, it's given $2.5 billion to Ukraine. It's been giving $500 million in the last few months, and the U.S. keeps offering or dangling in front of this right-wing Ukraine government NATO membership. There's every reason for the Russian government to be concerned about its security situation. We are not apologists for Putin and his politics, but any objective discussion of the security situation in that part of the world has to take into account the reality that one side keeps upping the stakes where the other side is offering to de-escalate. The diplomatic offerings have come from the Russian side so far. And moreover, the Russians have already agreed to what's called the Minsk II Accords, which demilitarized Ukraine and which the U.S. and NATO have largely ignored since they were negotiated back in 2015.
Joseph, I'd like you to comment, please, on the 2014 American-sponsored overthrow of the democratically elected government of the Ukraine. And in its place, they put in a new government and had several outright fascists in the new government. Could you talk to us about that, please?
Well, I've mentioned this 30-year period over which this crisis has emerged and gotten worse and worse as NATO has moved eastward. But that 2014 coup was a landmark event, and the U.S. was up to its neck in facilitating the coup and replacing what was a pro-Russian government of Viktor Yanukovych with a Ukrainian ultranationalist, in fact, neo-fascist government that has aggravated the whole situation since then. And I should also mention that one of the key actors in that was Victoria Nuland, who is the neocon's neocon, who was on the scene representing Obama in 2014. She's now back on the scene in the Biden administration as Undersecretary for Political Affairs. I'm hoping that she doesn't have her direct hands on these negotiations, because they're almost certainly not going to succeed if somebody as aggressive and militaristic as Victoria Nuland has her way, as confrontational as she is. So the 2014 events really set the stage for the worsening. And it set in motion other things. Ukraine is a divided society. It's got borders that don't actually conform to normal ethnic lines. And so the eastern regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, are Russian-speaking, and they are oriented toward Russia. The politics, it's highly industrial, working-class area. The politics are almost harked back to Soviet times. And so there's a kind of a left-wing Russian element in that part of Ukraine. Crimea is another Russian-speaking area that Khrushchev foolishly gave to Ukraine in some border adjustment sometime in the 1950s. When all of a sudden they've got a neo-fascist government in Kiev, these areas, which are making anti-Russian noises, these areas of Ukraine made their own decisions about their future. So you have separatist movements in the east, Donbass, and then you have in Crimea, I won't go into the whole sequence of events, but eventually there was a plebiscite, and 90% of the people of Crimea wanted to get out of Ukraine. So eventually it joined the Russian Federation. So all these things hark back, Michael, tonight to 2014. And so Victoria Nuland has a lot of explaining to do about her nefarious role.
Yes. And Joe, since the collapse of the former Soviet Union, to follow up on a point that I think you're making very well, many of the countries in that region who were once part of the former Soviet Union are now, since the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, members of NATO. And as a consequence, now more and more under the influence of the United States and the Western powers, then, of course, under the influence of Russia, leading to Russia's sense of insecurity on its borders. Russia, Putin, are concerned that they will allow Ukraine to now become part of NATO, that there'll be nuclear weapons in these NATO nations surrounding, more so than present, surrounding Russia. Is that not one of the key demands in these talks that are now going on, that this cease?
When the Russian proposals came out on December 17th, that was the fourth demand, namely keep Ukraine out of, and the central demand, keep Ukraine out of NATO. I did a little calculation in my Hammond World Atlas. The movement closer to Moscow, the NATO border has moved from 1,000 miles away to 250 miles away if Ukraine joins NATO. In a world of hypersonic missiles, when literally there are just a few minutes between the launch of an intermediate hypersonic missile and the moment of its impact, there is no room for missile defense, even if they had missile defense. The only way to prevent a threat to the security of Russia is to keep NATO away. And we also should bear in mind the history here. I've said several times it goes back 30 years. It goes back to the mid 20th century. The oldest generation of Russians lived through a war in which 4 million Hitlerite troops marauded through the eastern part of Russia and left 27 million dead. That is a historic memory that does not easily go away. We have to count that into the calibration of what's the political situation here. I mean, can you imagine if we had people putting ICBMs in Ontario pointed at New York and Chicago, or if Russian navies were sailing around Chesapeake Bay or the Gulf of Mexico? That's the kind of insecurity that the Russians feel. And Putin has said that point blank when he said it's really unreasonable for Russia to demand that we not have attack weapons outside our home. I want to make another comment about NATO, which is that most Americans have no idea what NATO is. The level of ignorance is astonishing. It's not the fault of most Americans. It's the media and the government that keep them that way. It's just a four-letter acronym. It rhymes with potato, and that's about all I know about it. Let's go down memory lane a little bit here. NATO was responsible for the dismemberment of Yugoslavia. NATO, in addition to the Afghan War, which went on for 20 years and ended ignominiously a few months ago, NATO was responsible for the Iraq War, at least the most of the elements of the Iraq War. NATO was responsible for the Libyan intervention that ended with the death of the head of state in a grisly assassination. In the Middle East and in Eastern Europe, NATO has certain ominous connotations that people know about. You don't have to be Russian to be afraid of NATO. And so that's something where we need to do a better job of educating people about what is this war alliance. And it's no exaggeration to call it a war alliance. It shouldn't exist. In fact, there was a very good piece in Black Alliance for Peace shared with Jim earlier today. NATO was supposedly to counter the Warsaw Pact. Well, the Warsaw Pact came into being 5 years after NATO, and it went out of existence at the end of the Cold War in 1990. NATO has just kept growing and growing. Now it's got 30 members. It even includes neutral states, Switzerland, Sweden, Finland, Ireland, Austria, in a quasi-NATO organization called Partnership for Peace. So I think we in the peace movement ought to do a better job of explaining to people that this organization is not benign and certainly not neutral. It's a threat to world peace. It ought not to exist any longer, because the conditions that allegedly caused it to come into being no longer exist. There should be no acquisition of all these countries that Slovenia, Slovakia, Czechia, Poland, all the countries that were formerly in the Warsaw Pact. There's no need for that to be them to be acquired by NATO and thereby pushing the border closer to Russia. So this crisis really is a crisis for a peace movement that hasn't really done its job fully, and so I think we need to be self-critical.
I just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Joseph Jamieson from the U.S. Peace Council. Joe, both the United States and Russia recently sat down in Geneva to see if they could talk matters over about missile deployment and thereby reach a peaceful solution to the present Ukrainian crisis. What's been the result of these talks?
Well, we don't know. They met in Geneva. They met in Brussels. That was a NATO meeting. And then they met in Vienna, and that was a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And now they've gone into suspension, or at least they're going back to check with their principals. The Soviet foreign minister, deputy foreign minister, and the American deputy foreign minister, Wendy Sherman, are checking with Mr. Putin and Mr. Biden, respectively. So we don't know. But time is short. This thing could still go either way. I don't personally, this is just my own personal opinion, I don't think Putin is bluffing. He does not have a lot of room to maneuver. There are diplomatic solutions are still possible, but I think the only government we can influence is the Biden administration, and we ought to be demanding as aggressively as we can that the Biden administration pursue every possible diplomatic channel. As recently as October, our Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, was over there in Kiev promising NATO membership to the Ukraine right-wing government. This is provocation. There's provocation in a military sense, too. The U.S. runs 30,000-strong war games on the borders with Russia. 80% of U.S. incidents in the air with aircraft are with Russian aircraft near Russian airspace. There's a lot that's been going on that most people are not privy to. That all of that has to stop. Back in the old days, when arms negotiations reached an impasse, and this sounds to me like it's at an impasse, it was possible to for the two sides to undertake confidence-building measures. Well, both sides could undertake confidence-building measures. The U.S. could stop its provocations and stop arming Ukraine. That would be one thing. The Russians could pull back some of those 100,000 troops. But this isn't rocket scientists. It's a diplomatic conflict. Every sane person in the world wants to see these two nuclear-armed powers take a step back from the brink. And it can be done if there's will. But I think we in the U.S. need to apply pressure to the Biden administration.
You've very well outlined, in essence, what the issues are. The nuclear weapons, you know, on the border of Russia, the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. Biden claims they don't want to put Ukraine into NATO, but hardly much reason to believe him. By the same token, Putin has said that they really aren't planning an invasion, and yet there's 100,000 troops or so on the borders of Ukraine. If you're looking at it, as you say, neither as a champion for Russia or as a champion for the United States, but simply as what seems fair under the circumstances, it's on the one hand hard to quarrel with what Putin is demanding of the United States. Certainly the U.S. would not tolerate on our border with Mexico or our borders with Canada or anywhere in Mexico or Canada the kind of military armament that Putin and Russia face being surrounded as they are by now so many more NATO nations. And therefore, it would seem as though for one side or the other to give in is to lose a great deal of geopolitical ground. And that's what makes, I guess, the situation so particularly scary. Do you think, in fact, that Russia can walk away from these talks or from this situation, leaving NATO and the U.S. exactly in the same positions it's in now, leaving the situation in the Ukraine as it is now, whereas Russia has offered some solutions to that, and have Russia simply back down? Can the West really expect to call Putin's bluff on this issue and get away with it?
When you have two great powers that have a lot of prestige at stake, there needs to be what the diplomats call a diplomatic off-ramp. And I don't think either side is going to get its full agenda. It's possible there could be assurances given by either side on secondary questions, but I don't expect an enormous breakthrough either for the U.S. side or the Russian side. I think that's just how, because the tensions have been ratcheted up so high. I took comfort today when I watched when I saw the New York Times, which didn't even have Ukraine on the front page for some reason. And I saw Morning Joe, where Anthony Blinken was mainly rattling on about the Havana Syndrome. And only under questioning from Mika Brzezinski, she's her father's daughter, who wanted to blame it on the Russians, did he even bring up the question of the Ukraine talks. So I think we ought to be assuming that the worst could still happen. But we ought to also have the confidence that the worst can be prevented.
Well, just a brief follow-up to that. If they do walk away with each side getting something but far less than what they're demanding, and particularly, and I should think, in Russia's case, but in either side, doesn't that mean that the crisis within Ukraine itself will continue and that, therefore, it is likely to flare up again down the road?
Did I hear you right? You're saying the crisis within Ukraine will flare up again?
Well, not only within Ukraine, but over the Ukraine will flare up again. I mean, the fact that they can reach perhaps some partial rapprochement for the moment doesn't really cure the underlying issues that are festering between the two sides, does it?
I mean, remember back, I'm old enough to remember, of course I was a teenager, but the Cuban Missile Crisis. The ostensible public solution was never really the real solution. There was, in addition to Khrushchev pulling his missiles out of Cuba, Kennedy pulled his missiles out of Turkey. Nobody knew that was going on. So there are ways of ratcheting this down, which, if there is political will, it can be done. That's the only hope I can offer. And I think our job is to create the political will. We have a little bit more time now after this week of diplomacy. And I would say our hopes of stimulating or stirring up the pot with our January 2nd piece, which I hope people will read at the uspeacecouncil.org, called The Escalating Crisis in Ukraine, it seems to have stimulated some of the other organizations to write to Biden. There was a letter published 2 days ago by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, which is a quite an establishment, but nevertheless an establishment think tank, but it argues for restraint in U.S. foreign policy. So it's run by a Committee for U.S.-Russia Accord, which is a creation of Stephen Cohen, the late Stephen Cohen, also joined in putting together a letter urging Biden to take the path of diplomacy and to ratchet down the pressure, ratchet down the provocations. So there is a sign that at least elements of the left and center, so to speak, are getting organized, and that we ought to use the time we have to do a better job at that.
Joseph Jameson, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time, but before we have to let you go, could you remind our listeners how they can reach the U.S. Peace Council and what they might be able to do to get involved?
Well, the U.S. Peace Council is not the biggest peace organization in the United States, but we're the United States representative of the biggest peace organization in the world, the World Peace Council. You can get acquainted with us by going to our website, uspeacecouncil.org. Information on how to join, how to get active, what our campaigns are. I'm involved with encouraging committees around the country to pass resolutions, having city councils demand that the $768 billion defense budget be cut. It's an obscenity. And we have lots of other campaigns of that type. Please get active with us and read the piece that we wrote, and thank you very much for this time.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Make sure you never miss an episode by emailing me on naomi@taxjustice.net, and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so for this edition, let me transport you to the island of Jersey, a British Crown dependency in the Channel Islands, close to the rocky coastline of France.
It is beautiful. It is. We moved there when I was a child. I was about 9 years old, and I just fell in love with Jersey. I thought it was the coolest place.
It is a beautiful place. It's also a tax haven, and it offers all sorts of financial secrecy. There's apparently £1 trillion sitting in this tiny island's trusts, companies, funds and foundations. It's a major artery into the city of London. Now picture St. John's Manor, a Jersey estate of 58 acres, a spectacular manor house with landscaped gardens, a lake, its own chapel, and a Japanese water garden.
It's in many ways like a fairy tale. It's got ponds and geese and chapel, and there's nothing like it. The air is better, you sleep better, or I used to sleep better there, and I really loved it. I'd hope to grow old there.
This is Tanya Dickstock, the daughter of Canadian multimillionaire John Dick. He's been immersed for years in court cases involving trusts, transactions, banks and law firms across the world. Much of them concern the activities of a Jersey trust company called La Hougue, which was once headquartered at St. John's Manor.
For some reason, different newspapers, news sources are still saying that my father allegedly owns La Hougue, or I'm alleging he owns La Hougue. No, I'm not alleging anything. A court of law, not one, but two, have adjudicated John Dick owns La Hougue. It's not me saying it. It's a court of law.
Okay, that shows you the kind of power a very wealthy person can have, doesn't it? So your parents set up a trust for you. Can you tell me about that?
I guess you could kind of look at it as an inheritance. Actually, the trusts were set up as part of my parents' divorce settlement. And so a large part of the marital assets, instead of being divided between the two of them, they put them into trusts specifically for my brother and myself. There were three different trusts there. And one of them, by my 40th birthday, I was to receive half of the trust assets. And then my brother, upon him reaching the age of 40, would have gotten his half. And how much was in the trust, we've tracked hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds. So I think there's at least half a billion. We're not done calculating yet. So.
And at some point, your father told you that the money in your trust was gone.
Yes. In 2010, he came to me one day and basically said, "Bad news, Tanya. The trusts are bust. All the money is gone. And I'm really sorry about that." And I'm thinking, whoa, hold on. There is no way that this money can be gone. I want to know what happened. When I did start digging into it, there was still about $100 million in assets still in the trust. They were still in the process of stealing the rest of it. What they'd done is put a bunch of fake debts on it. But at the end of the day, I was able to save about $100 million.
The "they" she's accusing are La Hougue trustees. Through his lawyer, a former trustee admitted in a U.S. court to fabricating documents. La Hougue and its current trustees deny fraud allegations put to it by journalists. You've probably noticed that Tanya didn't have your average childhood, being from the family that she was. And she says she's not motivated by revenge against her father.
It was very difficult for me to cut him out of my life, but it became, I had to remove that cancer, or it was literally going to kill me. It was frightening. It was initially sad, but it was really crazy how once I'd removed him from my life, completely cut him out, it was the first time I have felt at peace. I was safe.
The drama stopped.
Yes. You don't put yourself through what we have for money. And now it's about justice. And it's about everybody else. It goes beyond a movie. If you saw a movie, you wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, the Jersey's a mafia.
This is Darren Stock, Tanya's husband.
People on that island are scared to death of the authorities there. And who wants to live that way? You know, and you rapidly lose the gas to fight when it's just about the money. I've heard enough stories now that I actually have nightmares about what I've heard. Why we're doing these interviews is not for Tanya's sake. We're doing these interviews for the other people. We can be a voice. We can be an organizer. We can be the lightning rod to help bring change.
Since coming forward, I've been contacted by a lot of victims, people who don't have a voice. And they have encountered some of the same things that I did. I am by far not the only one who's been stolen from and defrauded.
This fight is not about a jilted daughter. It took us almost 3 years to come to the conclusion that we were going to go public. And then when Tanya and I made the decision to go public, we decided we couldn't go kind of public.
It's all or nothing.
Either you were going to do it all or you just don't do any. And then we decided that we had to put our name to it. So not only being a whistleblower, but actually attaching our name to it.
Speaking out publicly has meant laying out every aspect of their lives for journalists to check up on, including Darren's own dispute in the past over a tax bill in the States. But let's get back to Jersey. 10 years ago now, Tanya discovered a kind of Pandora's box of incriminating evidence. She found it in St. John's Manor, the incredible place where she grew up. And at the time, she was preparing for her wedding there.
In 2012, we were married on the 4th of July. And in the process of planning for the wedding, I was looking for a place that I could store all the boxes of tiki torches and flower urns and all the stuff that was coming in. And I needed a staging area. There was an old squash court and nobody used it. So I thought, well, that's perfect. It's close enough to the house, you know. So I got the master key out and I go running down there. I open the door and much to my dismay, I'm looking around and there are just boxes and boxes and boxes. Did you see Raiders of the Lost Ark? And you know that last scene where they've got the Ark of the Covenant and it's been boxed up and they're wheeling it in to, you know, that warehouse with all the boxes, and the camera pans back and you just see more boxes and more boxes. And that's what it felt like, because they were piled as tall as I was. And my heart sank because I'm thinking, I need this space for my wedding, you know, and they're dusty and they're dirty and there's like dried leaves and spider webs and dead bugs. And I'm thinking, ugh, this is trash. I got to get rid of it. So my first thought is let's toss it. And then I'm looking at the labels on the side and I noticed that there are trust names and some of them are my trust names.
There were 333 boxes in total. And what turned out to be 350,000 documents. So you had the wedding. When did you and your husband, Darren, get down to going through all this stuff?
Well, by the time we got back from our honeymoon, we started looking through the boxes that had my trust name on them. You know, I guess this is fate. I end up with the one guy who not only is smart enough to see what's going on, but he's also got an honest streak in him that's about a mile wide.
And we were this close to throwing him out, you know, and she ends up keeping them. And then it just kind of turns into one of those aha moments.
Typically what the trustees would do is they would just look at me and go, well, you don't understand. That's another thing that I found. It is a very male dominant system of what they do in Jersey. They're very chauvinistic. And it was, don't bother your pretty little head. You just don't understand. Don't worry about it. Go ask your father. And then my father would go, well, no, you have to talk to that trustee. That trustee would say, no, 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 it's that trustee. That trustee would say, oh, no, you have to talk to your father. I mean, you could never get a straight answer. And then what they would give me made no sense at all. So, you know, Darren is now in the picture and he's got a background as an investment banker. So I would go to him and I'd say, can you look at this? Am I crazy? And without having gone to law school, it would have been much harder for me to look at some of these documents and truly appreciate the implications of some of the documents I was seeing. I mean, some things you just know are wrong. Like I ran across a memo and they were talking about, you need to be careful when you're fabricating this document that you use old paper and old ink. So if they test it, they can't tell that it's a fake. And yeah, I think everybody pretty much understands that that's bad. But when you realize that they were creating shell companies and filling in fake debt, making assets disappear, and introducing it into court systems all over the world. Bankruptcies in Canada, in the UK, in the US. So you have no idea how damaging this stuff is.
There's a treasure trove of evidence on some who used LaHougue's services. Tax cheats, a pawn king and convicted tax fraudster, Russian and British oligarchs. There are links to the famous missing Botticelli Madonna and Child painting from 1485 and the disappearance of more than $100 million from the US savings and loan crisis back in the 1980s. So presumably some heat started to be felt in Jersey.
Yeah, LaHougue tried to move from Jersey in 2007-2008. LaHougue changed his name to Pantrust and moved to Panama. Pantrust is the extension of LaHougue. So in 2015, as we're digging into the boxes deeper, and then we were like, well, maybe we should go to Panama, you know, and go down there. And everybody's like, Panama's so corrupt and you'll never get anything out of it. Well, we thought, well, I mean, why not take a shot, right? So I myself flew down to Panama to meet with the regulator. And I was expecting, you know, we'd gotten some legal counsel down there. And what they had prepped me for was basically that we were going to go in and make a formal complaint to some junior person. And then that was going to, you know, probably have a junior lawyer involved. And then it would take an hour or two, then we'd go on. I walk in to the meeting, and it was pretty obvious early on that something was afoot, because they actually took us up to the main floor of where the headquarters of the regulator is, because in Panama, the trust world is regulated by the banking division. And so the head of regulation is actually a cabinet level position. So you're talking about an actual government agency that you're dealing with, you know, appointed by the president of Panama. I walk in to this boardroom that's got 40 people sitting at this table. I mean, the head of investigations, the head of police, the head of banking, the regulator himself is there. Their lawyers are there. And so we have triggered something. We walked into something and we don't know what it is. Now, at this stage, I still think John Dick is a good guy, right? Shortly after that meeting, the Panama regulator terminates Pantrust's trust license. The Panamanian regulator took the unprecedented step of issuing an unbelievably scathing letter of just the danger to society that this organization is. Panama, of all places, where everybody said they would do nothing, is the only jurisdiction that actually did something, which is the shocking part. And you look back at Jersey and you're expecting them to actually be the ones that would be the upstanding white knight, and they want nothing to do with this. They're shutting it down at every juncture. And then they go on the offensive to attack Tanya.
We'll get back to Jersey shutting things down in a minute. Tanya and Darren worked with a group of experts to help them track what were very complicated transactions over decades.
Then when we started tracking the money, you know, follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. And one day we were sitting with our advisors. We were in this hotel boardroom and these great big whiteboards all over the place. And we're drawing out transactions, companies, the money. We've got all these lines going. And every time it's going to one box. And we sat back and one of the people, I still remember it. My heart sinks even when I think about it now. And they went, "Oh my God, Tanya, it's your dad." And, you know, this is like early 2017, late 2016. And it was just, I was sick, absolutely sick, because I had been defending him. The trustees were saying, "Oh, it's your dad. Your dad's the one who told us to do this. We were just following orders." And he's saying, "They're lying. They stole all the money. I'm so sorry. I should have never trusted them." And then I find out, no, it was him.
That's something Tanya's father, John Dick, continues to deny. He says he was a victim of fraud too. But Tanya remembers as a child going into her dad's office and getting told off for playing with a load of old typewriters, old ink, old sheets of paper, stamps, all sorts of stuff. Tanya, why would anyone keep all those documents in the squash court that you found? I mean, why wouldn't you get rid of it all?
Yeah, the only reason that makes any sense at all is that he kept this to blackmail Jersey. This was his get out of jail free card. If anything ever went wrong, I went to the police expecting them to investigate and to do something about it because I had clear cut fraud.
Yeah, you run across the fraud, right? And mm-hmm. you've got the documents and you take it to the police and you're expecting a certain reaction, right?
I was told that Jersey places an affirmative duty on its people that if you see suspicious activity, you are bound by law to go and report it. You don't have a choice. So, you know, talk about suspicious activity. There was evidence of money laundering, fraud, identity theft. So Darren and I, we went to the police and we filled out police reports. One of the detectives came to the squash court and he's looking around all of these boxes and he says, "So all of these boxes are fraud?" And we said, "Yes." And he goes, "So it's not just like everyday records and, you know, a couple bad documents thrown in." We're like, "Well, you know, we haven't been through all the boxes, but no, I mean, it's pretty chock-a-block with fraud." And so he takes the cover off one of the boxes, he reaches in, he pulls out a random piece of paper, and it talks about shredding the documents, which is against the law. You have to keep the documents, you know, for trust companies. And it talks about shredding the documents, hiring commercial shredders, getting black bin bags, and then burning them at the tip. So he looked at that and he went, "Yep, okay, I take your point." And then the police seized the documents and the detective said it was one of the worst cases he'd seen where there was such a plethora of evidence. And it went from him being very excited about prosecuting it to him going, "Oh, by the way, I'm kind of retiring." So yeah, I think he got forced into retirement.
And it's when you start to engage with law enforcement and the courts in Jersey that the realities of a state captured by finance really start to show themselves.
Yeah.
And there's a culture in Jersey that they call the Jersey way. You know, you don't stand up and speak out against the kind of insularity and conflicts of interest that you get in a small jurisdiction like this. It's one of the reasons so many small islands tend to become popular places for secretive finance sectors.
I never understood it until I found myself in front of two Jersey judges. They were both my father's former lawyers for 20-some years, the head of the police commission. He was also my father's former lawyer. I mean, the conflict of interest is astronomical. When we started going through the boxes, I found another document, too, that made it very clear the trustee of LaHoob, the guy who was doing the day-to-day stuff, there was a memo he sent to my father, and one of LaHoob's clients was very unhappy and had threatened to go to the Jersey regulator. There's a memo that I found that was in the boxes where he writes to my father and he says, well, one of our clients has threatened to go to the Jersey regulator. He's very unhappy right now. And I told him that he could basically pound sand and I'm not worried about it because we'll just immediately pay our way out of it as usual. I'm like, pay our way out of it as usual.
But, I mean, you did take some steps. You must have suspected that the justice system in Jersey wasn't necessarily going to take action, right? Because you took quite a lot of steps to preserve that evidence, didn't you, before the police took it?
Well, actually, we were really lucky that we were able to copy a large chunk of it before we gave it to the police. But then the police allowed us access as well. So we went in and made further copies.
And they made copies.
And then the police copied a bunch of the boxes and gave us a digital copy of what they had copied. Yeah, I think we probably have about 80% of what was there.
And you've set about making much of that accessible to journalists through the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. And there are lots more conflicts of interest we haven't talked about. Incredibly, many of the 350,000 documents from the boxes were handed over by the police at some point to a Jersey law firm, which in 2015 was still representing Tanya's father. That was unearthed by journalist Leah McGrath Goodman of the Institutional Investor. Now, that law firm denies any relationship with LaHoob and says it currently has no relationship with John Dick. So I've been to Jersey. I mean, it looks good, doesn't it? I mean, you know, I've been to the court in Jersey. It has a nice coat of arms, oak panelling, you know, the little parliament building. It all looks good. But when I went to Jersey for the TaxCast in edition 88, I spoke with people like the co-founder of the only political party in Jersey. I mean, I know the whole system there is not, it's not really functional, is it?
It's like a movie set.
Yeah.
Because what you think you're looking at and what's really happening are two very different things.
Yeah. And why it's important for other people to pay attention to what's happening here, because this really affects everyone, the rule of law.
Yeah, there is a danger, a wider danger to everybody. So a lot of Tanya's money has disappeared into someone's accounts. There are ongoing legal processes. It's taken you both a lot of determination because a lot of people wouldn't have pursued things this far. And I've spoken to people who've lost their pensions, lost everything through scams that have used offshore secrecy and the impunity that can exist in those places. And it's been really devastating to them. But tax havens, secrecy jurisdictions also attract a lot of people doing unsavory things, you know, hiding criminal proceeds, cheating on their taxes, that type of thing. And they're not going to go to the authorities when they get ripped off. So, you know, you have this really big culture of impunity left right and center. And there's often a kind of panic to protect the jurisdiction from any negative publicity, from any scandal, because they don't want to drive away the money.
Yeah. When we started pushing on this, we've run across some very horrific crimes. I mean, it's very black and white what had happened, and Jersey would not investigate it. And on the surface, I think people look at that and they go, Jersey's trying to protect its good reputation. And the reality of it is they're not. What they're really trying to do is protect their bad reputation. Because what they're trying to tell the underworld is, come to us and nothing will ever be investigated. You can do whatever you want and nothing will be investigated. And that's the signal that they're sending to the underworld to bring the business there. Where I think the average guy walking down the street sees or hears this rumor that Jersey's not doing an investigation, and they're like, well, they don't want to tarnish their image. You're missing the point. It's quite different. You know, we've been contacted by people in Jersey that had their home stolen. And that's why Tanya was such a threat to them, sitting with 350 boxes of some of the most incriminating evidence. And, you know, the last thing they're going to do is do an investigation. And the first thing they're going to do is go on the offense against Tanya. And now that Tanya's gone public with it, of being a whistleblower on it, we've had a lot of people come forward with a lot of information. Now it's a matter of just going, what does it mean to us as a society? What it means is, if you've got enough money, you can literally buy the judiciary, you can buy the police, you can buy the whole ball of wax. And I don't think that's what the people of Jersey signed up for.
They've weaponized the court system against what they perceive as a threat. And I was a threat because I wanted justice.
So the system has been bastardized in a way. Now it works for the 2% and it punishes the other 98%. And what we want to be able to do is help Jersey spin it backwards where it helps the other 98% and it punishes the 2% that are doing the crimes.
Do you ever think about letting it go and walking away? I mean, what will be enough for you to say, now I'm at peace? I've got what I want. We've got what we wanted from all this fighting and all this trouble and pain.
Really good question, because that's actually something he and I have been talking about lately is, you know.
And it's not money. It's not the money.
What's the goal? You know, when do you take your spurs off and set your hat down and go, all right.
Yeah. We want to change the narrative. And what people need to understand is that when you bring that bad element onto your turf, it all comes with a cost. There's a yin to the yang. And it's like a cancer. If you don't deal with it, it will kill the host. You know, it's inevitable. They're not going to investigate anything because any investigation is going to unearth what they don't want the world to see. And that's the tragedy. And at some point, you get to a point of no return. And that's where I think Jersey's gotten to. It'd be the last place you'd do business. We're talking to the people of Jersey and the people of Cyprus and the people of the United States and the people of England, because what's happening is the rot that's in Jersey, and I could give you example after example after example of where they've exported it all over the world and absolutely decimated your court, and you don't even know it. This is a much bigger picture, and it literally touches each and every person.
For me, it's about accountability. I want to see reform in Jersey. I want a spotlight on judges, on the police, on the entire justice system.
Yeah, people in Jersey should be very concerned. They should be listening to Tanya quite closely. But so should the people in England, and so should the people in Canada, and so should the people in the United States, because we've seen them literally terrorize the banking system in the United States, the judicial system in the United States, and in Canada, and in the UK, and in Russia, and in Cyprus. It runs everywhere.
It's now 10 years since Tanya and Darren discovered these 33 boxes of evidence in St. John's Manor in Jersey. In Panama, the authorities revoked LaHue's sister company's license so it could no longer operate from there. In the US, there have been important admissions in court, and litigation is ongoing. In Jersey, there have been no criminal charges, prosecutions, or regulatory penalties imposed by Jersey's authorities. But what Jersey courts have done is award some huge costs against Tanya Dickstock, and block her from participating in its court proceedings. These Jersey rulings, with all their conflicts of interest involved, could prejudice or at least influence courts in other jurisdictions. Financial secrecy is really at the heart of it, and it really needs to go. And for that, laws must change, and financial regulators and tax authorities must be independent, well-funded, and empowered to enforce those laws. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. My special thanks to investigative journalist Nikki Hager, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll be back next month.